Welcome to True House Stories. I'm Lenny Fontana coming out of New York City. And this week, we have a special duo. These guys are what I call the next generation of disco house, disco house, jack and house, however you want to put it. They're just top guys, excellent producers. And before I say anything more about who they are, they topped the UK singles charts back in 2022 with a song called Afraid to Feel. And if I remember correctly, it earned them a gold record by the British phonographic industry. And that's pretty cool, you know? These two guys, one named Connor and the other named Sean Finnegan. Connor Larkman. Sean Finnegan out of Scotland, and you're going to hear a little bit of a strange twang to their voices because they got a heavy Scottish accent, and we may have to ask them to say one more time, please repeat, because even the Londoners tell me, damn, what'd they say? And I have to sometimes say, they said this, because I'm really good at this. You know, I've learned to kind of pick up all kinds of different English dialects, but anyway, I'd like to welcome to the show some of the best of today's DJs, record producers, and the duo team of LF Systems.
Hello.
Whoa, welcome, fellas. Hello. Out of Miami.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you, mate. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Finally getting some sun in Miami. Obviously, a long way from home. So just before this, I've been I've been in the sun. Sean's not been in the sun, but I was sitting chilling by the pool, resting before a couple of shows in Miami. So, good.
Okay, so before we get started, what kind of tan lotion, what number are we using? 30, 50, 100? What are we using of UV?
I'm on the 50, or complete avoidance of the sun. That's usually what I do. That's my factor, complete avoidance.
And I've actually not got any on because we don't have any. We've never got that far to buy any yet. So, but make sure that. Just dip myself in a wee bit, but maybe 10 minutes and out, 10 and out.
Be careful, because that Miami sun's tricky. It burns. It does burn. Be careful. I've been there, done it.
So, as long as I get a tan.
Wait, what was that again? Say it again.
As long as I get a tan.
Because you know what? Back in the day when I traveled like that, when before this came about and people knew what we were doing, I used to say I was traveling here and there, and they'd be like, why are you going to go play here? Because there was no way of explaining to people that I was coming back in the middle of the winter fully tanned, like being in Australia or being in places where it was full on summer, and they're looking at me going, why are you doing this? I'm like, I just go for the tan, just for the tan.
I don't go for the tan. Connor goes with that, but I know it's like, it's so different now. It's like, even try to explain though what you're doing to people still, especially like our parents didn't really understand it at first. But
I still don't.
But I think we think it's a big holiday sometimes. But,
you feel like you're on a 365 holiday, right?
That's it. There's some work in between the getting, you get, which one you get, it's nice. I mean, it's the best job in the world to get to travel this, so it's.
Here's the question: is the DJing the job or the traveling the job?
We've always said that the traveling's the job. The DJing, that's easy, it's fun, it's good, as that's the best bit. It's the traveling that's the hardest part. But the traveling's not. It's like you feel bad for complaining about it, but I mean, we still do.
We still complain, but like the DJing part when you finally get there. You know, and you get that hour and a half or 2 hour set, whatever you get, and you forget about all that stuff, all that traveling you've done, like, instantly. So, and then obviously that levels up, but the airports are rough when you're, especially when you do a set, and then you have to go straight to the airports and stuff like that. But it's funny what Sean says, it's like, you find yourself complaining about travel, but all it is you sit in your bum. You just like, it's like, how can you complain about just sitting there? But it's one of those things, it's just, you have to do it to be in this industry, and it's like just take on the chin. So,
well, we're gonna cry for you more and more as you keep traveling around the world. You said, boys, you
I know. Right? What a sob story. Traveling.
All right. People want to know you. We know you guys are workers. We know you're grafters. We know you've came together. But we want to hear from your mouths on how this music thing found you as young kids. And then, you know, you can each tell your story. And then we'll go one by one. We'll pick you apart. Mincemeat, potatoes, little gravy. we'll get the nitty gritty out of you, because I don't think people really got to hear who you are. Mm-hmm. And this show wonderfully gets to do that. So take your turns, guys.
You first.
You go first.
I was always in music when I was younger. My dad and my family, there was a lot of Oasis, like British rock pop music when I was growing up. Blah, Oasis. And my brother was in the guitar. I still can't play instruments. Never learned how to play any. I think I tried occasionally, but and then I think I was 13 and that's when I discovered dance music. I was 13 years old. I found EDM music. So it was like Avicii and all stuff like that, and when I was younger. And then I discovered Daft Punk, which really changed my outlook on dance music. And that's when I went down this rabbit hole of figuring out how you actually made this music. Because I thought you used DJ decks to make music. That's how like naive I was at first. So, and then I had to went this rabbit hole to YouTube tutorials and all these different things, just like figuring out how to do it, cracked copies of software, all that kind of stuff. And I was a musical family, but I think I took my own kind of path and discovering like disco music and funk music and stuff like that. It was just something I sort of picked up from looking at records, and I just got attracted to it. I don't know what it was about it, but yeah, I was just naturally attracted to disco and funk and soul and stuff like that.
And my story is very much my dad. Where I'm from in Falltowes in West Lothian, small place in Scotland that probably most people in the world would never know about. But it's a very musical place. There was always things happening. My dad was in a band. So I grew up, it was like kind of like a rock band that he was into. But in his youth, he always used to go to soul weekenders and used to travel a wee bit and get a wee bit high and go listening to some soul music and stuff like that. So just my full life, I was always and about that music, especially like soul and rock and U2 and stuff like that. It was always in the family. But you would always have, if you would go on family holidays, you would have the old records on and things like that. And as I grew older, there's always just been, especially Motown. Motown is massive, and where I'm from, Falltowes, it's like a big thing just in the town. In the town, it's like you go to, there's a wee place called the Welfare. That was based on like the old, where the old miners used to go. My granddad used to go, and it was always used as a club for like my dad and stuff, and his friends, and there would always be like that type of music on. And so even now to this day, if there's like something on in Falltowes and you go down, a couple of my dad's friends still in a band that used to be in the band with him, and they're called Soul Sensations. And basically just to cover the old soul music. So, and everybody does the soul train and stuff like that. So it's always been a big part of where I'm from. But then when I got older, I was the exact same as Sean, got into the EDM music, obviously starting to get to that age where you start drinking alcohol. You get to that age, you're like, oh, I want to get a wee bit involved in that. So, because you Calvin Harris a lot, got into Teen the Park, which was a festival in Scotland. We used to put these things on instead of like, I ended up going away because in my teenage life it was very much like Sean Oasis and Kasabian and Two Door Cinema Club, and picked up the guitar for a wee bit. It was in a music, done like a wee music thing in school where I learned how to do ACDC, one of the ACDC songs, and played it on the stage. I wasn't very good. I still remember how we played it to this day, but I sadly put down the guitar. But then I found like going out and then I found EDM, that kind of electronic music. But then my sister ended up going out with her boyfriend, who's now her husband to this day, and he was older, and he was already going out, and he was going to places like Sub Club. some club, and he was listening to all the like Defected and stuff like that. And I still remember this day he came. And once we got I got comfortable with him, he started showing me that kind of stuff. They showed me the Defected podcast, and it was when Copyright had it, which was quite a long time ago. And then I used to listen to that relentlessly. Because when I was working, my granddad used to make me cut his grass and do stuff like that. So I used to have it in my headphones religiously, and at school, should have been learning, but I was just listening to music podcasts. And so started doing that. And then one day I went to some club and went to see Detroit Swindle, and who are now Damn Swindle. And they played Flow Plan, Never Grow Old. And he came home from that. He came home very rough on that Sunday and stayed with my sister and showed me that song. And I was like, what is that? Like, that was like, I was already listening to Defected a wee bit. And I was, that was the more the house's sound and stuff like that. But he showed me that song, and it was something in my brain just clicked when I heard that song. So that's why I've got the artwork tattooed in my arm to this day, because it meant that much to me. And then I used to play football, but I was like, nah, because I was starting to go out, and I was like, scrap that. I was like, asked my dad on our family holiday one day, please buy me a pair of decks, which it took a lot of convincing, but after a wee while, he said yes. And I was actually at school, and I had to go to like a university, it was like a university open day, so I was still at high school. So, and then you were allowed to go to like different universities in Scotland to see like what it's like, and then they tell you blah, blah. But I knew I was never going to go to university. So I just used that day. My dad had ordered the decks, but I had to go pick them up. So I said I was going to Glasgow University. But actually, instead of going to university, without telling the school, I went to the shop where they were selling the decks, picked up my decks, and then went home. Learned how to do the basics on the decks, but obviously using the computer and stuff like that. And then I just spiraled from there, and I was just obsessed with it. And then I eventually, because the DJing usually leads into learning how to make music. So I was like, I want to learn how to do that. And then obviously started like just religiously just on YouTube, like Sean was as well. Bought like a couple of like, it was like tutorials and how to use Ableton. And I went through every kind of software as well, like, and I couldn't understand any of them, but found myself going back to Ableton. And then, learned how to do that a wee bit. And I've never stopped since. And then was on the roofs working away, but with a vision that I knew I wanted to do DJing and making music.
Wait. You said you were roofing?
Yeah.
So petrol station?
That's me.
What were you doing at the petrol station?
Serving petrol. So I used to stand behind the counter, and people would come in and say, pump five. And I'd take their money off them. And then I would stack the shelves. With the petrol, because it was a petrol station with like a shop in it. So I had like I had to stack shelves at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'd stack shelves, and then I'd serve petrol for 8 hours. And that was my job for 7 years before this.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, you did 7 years as an attendant at the shop?
7 years. Yeah, 7 years. It was I could not stand that job. One bit.
Say it slowly to everybody. How much did you love your job? You must have loved it.
I hated that job more than anything that I've ever done. And I think it was a good catalyst for doing this, because I just had it in my back of my mind. I was like, I do not want to do this any longer. Mm. And I was always DJing on the side with Connor and stuff like that and making music. But so I used to finish work at 10 p.m. And we'd have a show in Edinburgh at like 11 p.m. So I'd bring my clothes with me, my headphones and stuff like that, and get changed in my car after work, drive straight to the club, and we'd play. And then I'd sometimes start work at 6 a.m. the next morning. So I'd have to drive from the club back to work and do my shift again, serving petrol.
So after being like this and everybody going nuts, you're going like this now.
What do you want to see?
Five on number pump three.
Yeah,
you want to go tell them, go F yourself, get the hell out of here, right?
That was because I was doing that, and it was like, this is what I want to do. It's like, I'm just putting everything. Like, I've no qualifications from school. I was just trying to do this at the same time as this job that I really didn't like. I was working part time just to allow more time to make music and DJ and stuff. And it was like a lot of time we'd be, I'd be working on a Friday night, and Radio One would be on. And we'd have like three songs getting played on Radio One by Pete Tong, Danny Howard, Annie Mack. And I'm standing in this petrol station thinking how, like, I thought when you made music that's what you do. And I was like racking my brains, like, why am I still working in this petrol station? And all these things seem to be happening. But I think it's sorry.
Here's a question I wanted to ask Sean. You mentioned your father had a band. Was his band famous in Scotland?
It's Connor.
Connor. You mentioned your dad's band. Was it a famous band, or was it a pub type band?
No, so it wasn't a famous band, but obviously they had the full intentions of becoming that. And it was actually just before the shift to the 90s music, like Oasis and stuff, when they first came through, and the other Manchester sound came through. And it's a funny story, actually. They went down to London to record an album, like a record label, and then they were about to give them the deal, and then they went down to record the album and stuff like that. And just before everyone went through, that new sound came through. So you know how labels are, and then record labels, they were like, times have shifted and stuff like that. So they never really got the chance, but they were called Rejoin the Party. There's a couple of videos on YouTube if anyone wants to go check them out.
My dad was... videos out, everyone. See, I always find things out through this show, tidbits of other famous things that happen or backstories. It's like interesting that's when I heard that. I was like, I wonder if that band became like U2. You know what I mean? Like some like big band. I'm like, I mean,
a lot of the videos are from just from the rehearsals, and like obviously in some of the some of them in the pubs and filters, like at Welfare and that, like I was talking about. My dad was a keyboard player, so in all the videos, I'm not a very tall guy, and obviously I came from my dad, so near as he. But you can just see him in the back, and he was a keyboard player, and he's in the corner. But they were all best friends, and they're still best friends to this day, and obviously they all went on to do have their own lives. But so that's why, especially like when I mentioned doing music and stuff like that, it was very much like my dad pushed me and got me everything that I would need. He was brilliant, everything that I would need to succeed. So I owe a lot to...
I like this part. When you said you were going to uni and you went to the electric shop to pick up the decks and you circumvented, made a right turn and said, see ya.
I had no intention to actually go to uni. That's the thing. And even my dad was in on it as well. He was working. So he was like, well, just say you're going to, just for a nosy to Glasgow Uni. I never had the grades to go to uni. Not one bit. So he was in on it, and he just said, "Well, go to Glasgow and pick the decks up and come home."
How did the roofing become the moment of trade for you? Where did that come into play?
So that when, like I just mentioned about it, I started working in retail in a shop in West Norman in Livingston called Top Man. I don't know if you get that in America, but it's not a thing anymore, actually. Anyway, but I started working there, and they gave me 6 hours a week, and I had left school. There was just one day I was in, like, I made it to 6 year, like the last year, but it was a month, maybe not as long as that, into the first year, 6 year. And I remember sitting in class, and instead of learning, I was just reading the manual of how, like, see when you learn to drive a car, you have to do the, what's it called?
Theory.
You have to do the theory bit. So I was just sitting in class learning my theory, and I was like, well, there's no point in me being here. So I just said to my dad and mum one day that I'm not going back. He was like, well, you're going out to get a job. So I got a job, and it was like 6 hours a week. And so I was only getting six, and the rest of it, I was just sleeping. As teenagers do, sleeping for like 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day. And my dad was like, no, this is not happening anymore.
I have to stop you. You don't see me laughing right now when you're talking about sleeping all day, because I have a daughter that's 24, and I know exactly what you're talking about when you're saying this. I'm going, yeah, I'm a father. So I was the father going, what are you doing?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened then. Obviously, basically not, and he would come in, I would still be in my jammies, sitting on the couch. Exactly where he left me before he went to work. something. I'd just stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning watching films. So and then one day, one of his friends who was in the band, he has his own he's a carpenter, he has his own carpenter company. And he obviously knows a lot of people. So he had where his office was beside a roofing company. So my dad got his pal to go in, his friend to go in and basically say, we've got a young boy here, is like 16, 17 I was, like, yeah, give him a job. So my dad came home one day, was like, right, you're going into the AW Roofing, it was called. You're going in there, did an interview, and then they got started as an apprentice.
And you said, like, I am? I'm going to go where? To the roof. You're going to, tomorrow, you clean up, you shower, and you get ready for your interview.
Yeah, and I was just like, no, I'm not. And he was like, just made sure.
Oh,
no,
you got your ass, you are. You get your ass, otherwise you ain't coming home tonight, right?
And then the full thing was, he was like, just get your apprenticeship done, and then you can move on to what you want to do. Obviously, I knew what I wanted to do, but it was obviously a long shot away. But then obviously done my apprenticeship, and then ended up staying there, like maybe 3 or 2 years after I had passed. But as I was doing music now, like Sean said, when he was working in the garage, our songs were coming on the radio. I remember being, I don't know if you know,
what song was being played in the radio? That, you know, I keep hearing about this. Which song was this song that you're saying to yourself, why are we going to work every day when we got a song playing on the radio?
There was quite a few. Mm. The first one was, let's try to go.
Bougie, it was Bougie. The first one?
Bougie Bougie, it was called. It was one of the first songs we released. I don't know what age we were, maybe at that time, 21 or something like that.
Something like that.
21 or 22, I think. It was one of the first songs we've ever done, and it was got played quite a lot on Radio 1. And then we had a song called We Can't Be Dreaming. It was on Radio 1 quite a lot. It was a more electronic song that we've not actually done much of since, but and then there was a track called, we made a lot of demos during, that have never been released, that got played on the radio a lot. Mm-hmm. We used to send them directly to Annie Mac and Pete Tong in the hope that they'd play it. So during COVID and stuff like that.
Did you guys in the envelope send a little bit of like that Scottish money in there? with the little autograph saying, thank you so much, make sure you play it. And
please.
I was like, I had to bribe them. No, I didn't really.
Dancing Cliche was the one that started getting day radio.
Dancing Cliche made the day radio on Radio 1 and
different other stations. During COVID, we're working together, right?
Yeah, okay. So
take us back as roofing and petrol station work and your DJing is up, but how did we come together and create this whole partnership and formulate this thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if we go right back to the start, we both played football or soccer when we were teenagers, and the first time we ever played, we used to play in the same league in football because we're from the same area, and we played against each other when we were 12, 13 years old, but we never knew each other, we never knew who each other were, and we played each other at football for years, 5-6 years probably. And then it wasn't until we went to a nightclub in Glasgow called The Arches that got shut down.
I played The Arches.
Yes,
sorry. I didn't mean to
cut it. More about that. We met each other, I think we were 17 years old, went to see Defected in The Arches. Mm. And
it was like a Simon Dunmore.
Sonny Federa.
And
Sam Devine.
And
we bumped into each other, and I think my friends were friends with Connor through football and stuff as well. And but we got talking about music in a nightclub, and then we started talking about like kick drums and snares and stuff like that. And we were being the little geeks in the corner talking about music.
What's your favourite 909?
how do you process your 909 stuff like that? And people would be like, what are you talking about? Because nobody was into that kind of stuff we were from. Nobody made dance music, or we both never knew anybody who produced music or anything like that. And it's a big thing now where we're from. but it wasn't like that back then. And yeah, we got talking in this club, and we started going out with each other, and started going to these other events in Glasgow and Edinburgh, and just became friends. And we started a night in Edinburgh called Hybrid, and we started it with our manager, who's still a manager to this day. He was just a friend at the time, and within his living room one night, and we thought, why don't we try and start a DJ event. Me and Connor, and I think there was 10 of us in this DJ group at the start. So we used to play for 30 minutes in a nightclub because there were so many of us. So to make our time longer, we used to play back to back. So instead of like 15 minutes each, we used to get half an hour together. And then we just bonded over the same type of music. And I think that went on for quite a few years doing that. And we're still working at this time, obviously, all that kind of thing. We're doing our own thing. And we ended up folding that group, that hybrid group, a few years later. And then we decided, why don't we just, because we're playing a lot of back-to-backs, but it was individual, it was under our own names. So we said, why don't we just do it together? And one day we just decided to come up with the name and start an Instagram and just start making music.
Because it's one of those things, because we'd been doing it together for so long. I was mentioned a friend, like there was a manager. At that time, we were thinking about being our own aliases and doing it like just separate. But we'd got so used to doing it together, and it was so much fun. And before that, we'd travel to each other's houses and make music together. But like just for fun and learning and picking up things from each other and different ways of doing things, and then. One day, our manager said to us, he was like, well, right, we're going to launch this thing. And Sean was just about to have a song out, which is a really good insider here. Is the Bougie Bougie track was a song actually that Sean made a long, long time ago when I think he was 16.
It was in high school too, yeah.
And the label picked it, a local label from West Lothian picked it up, and... just before he was about to sign the contract, as Sean Finnegan, our manager, was basically said to us, right, do you want to do this as a solo act, or you've been doing it for so long together, but as something, a duo, something you should look at? And me and Sean always were quite nervous, maybe sometimes it doesn't come across, but quite nervous people, and the thought of them, obviously give credit to all the DJs that can do it solo, but doing all the travel and dealing with all the giggings at yourself and not having anybody, because obviously we know each other, we're friends, outside music, we're going out together just in the normal nightclubs, and so it was like that familiarity and like comfort there. So it was like this thing where like the thought of then now being separate when you've done it for so long together and having to deal with the travel yourself and deal with all the music and stuff like that, it was quite a scary thing. So the minute our manager said, just want to do it as a duo, we never knew it was an option, let's do it like straight away. I didn't even think twice about it, and then we had half an hour to go up,
so you had a manager already and it'd be right from the jump start of your career.
So he wasn't a manager at the time, he was like a local promoter essentially in Edinburgh, and he was doing other things as well, but we became friends with him. We used to go back to his house after nights out and for after parties and stuff like that. And I think he knew Connor before me, and he said to Connor about starting a DJ event. Mm. He said, do you know anybody? And Connor mentioned me. And we just became friends, and I think it wasn't like I'm going to be your manager. It was just like, let's just do this thing together.
Mm.
And it's just been the exact same ever since.
Well, you know, yeah. What's really good is that somebody knew the business, because this is where the problem always lies. You have the talented people that love what they do. Like you said, you were hanging out in the club talking about 909 hi-hats and kicks. You're not thinking about contracts and the dark side of the business, which is good that somebody said, let me, you know, you sure you want to do this under your name, or you want to do this as a collective?
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly. A smarter move, because a lot of times these contracts sign your names for eternity. then what? Mm-hmm. You know, in this case, a smart idea. So the first single you both signed together was not Dancing Cliche. It was Bougie Bougie. Is that a sample as well?
Yeah, yeah. It's a Gladys Knight and the Pips. It's a Gladys Knight and the Pips. It's a cover version mm-hmm. of Ashford and Simpson's Bougie Bougie. And Gladys Knight and the Pips covered it, and we sampled that. Like I think I sampled it when I was like 16 or 17 years old. I was mm-hmm. in high school at the time. But I think it was one of the first things I put on SoundCloud, because I was too self-conscious and too embarrassed to put music out or tell anybody that I was doing music. I was just doing it quietly.
Yeah, that's another thing. We would make these tunes, and we wouldn't show anyone but each other. Like, what do you think of this? And then we just sit on this music without any confidence, real confidence that these are any good. And so that's another thing we helped each other with, was like actually gain the confidence to then, yeah, that's good. Like you need that other person that was doing it, and then to be like, to give you a wee bit of...
Are you ready? Like, that's shite.
There was definitely a few that were shite.
Let's be real, because your friends are the worst. They're the worst, especially when they're drinking and they hear something. Oh man, it's like you got to be careful, because it could destroy your career before you even start. You're like, so I understand why you're very careful about making people hear your stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think it goes both ways. I think, because sometimes it's worse when somebody goes, "That's amazing." Sometimes you need somebody to tell you that's not good, so you need to think about it. No, that's not good.
And that's a problem too. They give mm-hmm. you the flags of joy and love, and they're mm-hmm. not being honest either when it's bad. So it's like, what do you do? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like
they're just nodding and being like, "Yeah, it's good," but not really either cited or telling you it's rubbish.
Mm-hmm. When they left, that thing they played. That's why they call our best friends, because they love us to death. They'll tell you, "Yeah, you're the best." He was shy.
that's a sign of a true good friend, though. If you've got a friend that keeps telling you that you're a world beater, then keep your eye out, because it's
the same great. Thing that when you know you're doing something great, or you think it's great, and somebody comes in the room and says, "I'm not feeling that." Mm-hmm. And you're like, "What do you mean?" It's mm-hmm. happened many times to all of us. So mm-hmm. over the years, you find that you think that thing is the bomb you're working on, and some woman walks in and goes, "I ain't feeling that." You're like, "Really? Really? All right." Later on, you wind up scrapping it because you know they're right months later, but you're just so angry at the point at that moment, you know.
I know, especially if you're so set on something, you hear something like that. I think that's something you learn, is that it's almost like if it appeals to you, then it'll appeal to somebody else. Sometimes you just don't have to listen to what people have got to say. Mm. Like, you got to take advice and stuff like that. But I think, if you get caught up in other people's opinions, then you probably never put anything out. Mm. So as long as you enjoy it, I think that was always important to us. It was like we didn't care really what. Like, we did care, and then we got to this point where it's like, we enjoy it, mm-hmm. and we're just making music for ourselves and putting these things on SoundCloud for free downloads, and it was just to share music that we liked, and people didn't like it, it was fine. It was just for us to play out, and that's why I think that the more that went on is that you start thinking about that again. You start getting caught up in opinions, and when people are actually hearing your music, because back then it was just, we were just doing it for the pure fun of it, and we still try to keep that. But you do have that kind of nagging feeling in your head that you go back to that thing that people might not like it, but you shouldn't really care.
Yeah, of course. And then you get the fears, and then you're like, you start questioning yourself, your movements. So in your world of LF, how is the workflow work? Do you guys have like meetings about, "Oh, we're going to do this," or is it just a jam session? Like, what happens in your world? You know, people want to know that. What's going on in the lab?
We've got a very unique way of making the music, which I don't know if it's very common for duos, but for us, because we started as solo just making music totally differently on different software as well. He was FL Studio and I was Ableton. We were making music totally different, and we had our own ways of doing stuff and their own sound. And obviously, but when the LS stuff came about, we've always remained making music, like kept it the same way. We, a lot of the time, me and Sean make songs separate and then come together. We then discuss, we'll go through them and be like this is what I've made, this is what I've made. Like, do you like that? Do you like that? And now and then we come together and then we flush it out together. Or sometimes even we'll just add bits separately. But a lot of the time we'll come together and we'll finish them as one, but we'll start them as separate because we work very differently. Sean has, he's got his like strong bits that he's really good at, and I've got my bits that I'm good at. So it's very, so you get best of both worlds, and it's a very unique way of doing things, which is some people, sometimes when we tell people, they're like, oh, really? Like, so it's a lot of, sometimes they don't, one part of the duo doesn't get involved in the music, but they just DJ and the other one makes the music. And but we've always, we've just stuck to the process, but how we started, and it's so far worked out for us. Mm. So
that's what we used to do. We used to, when I was like 17 or 18 years old, we used to swap projects with each other, mm-hmm. and we used to finish each other's projects if we were stuck. And it's still the exact same as we're doing now. We upload it to Dropbox, and then Connor will work on my project, and I'll work on Connor's project, and we'll touch them up, and then we come together and finish it, mm-hmm. Together.
Yeah.
So you guys are actually one studio, formulating mm-hmm. ideas, and then having that meeting, and then, oh, let's finish that. Let's work on that. You know what? If you do that to that, that can work like that. It exactly. works. Look, you know, a lot of people are working now with Zoom or, you know, from one studio to another virtually through Steinberg. There's a lot of different ways of doing stuff now. So I'm not surprised to hear you tell me your studio, he's at his studio, and then both of you come together as one. Mm-hmm. That works.
A lot of the time we find ourselves, because what we are better at now when we come together to start, especially when we're in sessions, that's totally fine because it's a brand new thing. And you've obviously got session players in there that's helping with the actual playing parts and stuff like that and top liners. But a lot of the time we found what would happen when we would come together to actually start something new is we would not, because our brains are separate people and we've got different ideas and things like that. It would end up clashing a wee bit where it was like there was too much going on to that way. There was too much going on in the one session. So you'd find that it'd feel a bit this one person wouldn't be doing something, and then, or that like maybe not disagreeing, the person's like, fuck you, that's not how I'm not doing that. But like, it would just end up sometimes not be as fluent. So, and it's like that thing, if your process isn't broke, it's like, don't change it.
Well, that's what makes a marriage well, gentlemen. You know, marriages, you fight. You know, there's dog fights in the room. Come on, that's, you know. We love each other. We hate each other. We don't want to be each other now, but we have no choice because it works. Which brings me to the point of, so you're chugging along, you're getting Radio 1 success, and you come across doing this track, I Can't Stop. You get this in your hand. So I want to hear about this because this is important to dance music.
Yeah, I think the same kind of story is that I think it was 2019, mm-hmm. I think the first version was created. It started with me just finding a sample. I was just doing what I usually do, going through YouTube, trying to find low view records from 1979. Was usually like the sweet spot that I found that I liked. And I made a version of it, made like a really slow, like kind of like disco version almost, you could call it. And same again, showed Connor, said, what do you think of this? And he was really into it. And he made a version that was, he made like a fast version with like the 909 stuff like that and sped up. And we were going to release two versions of, just going to put two versions on SoundCloud called like slow version and fast version, or disco and house version. And we thought, oh, why don't we just make it one version? So that's where the slowdown came from, was to slow it down to my version and speed it back up to Connor's version.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing that, we were doing the slowdown thing quite a lot. We were like, just, I don't know, I think we, I mean, like Little Louis, Fetch Kiss, inspiration mm-hmm. from that.
Elvis, didn't it?
Elvis, 1990, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, there's a lot of Echo's done it, but we done it all the time. We were like slowing everything down and speeding everything back up.
I went through, like a stage of just like every song, we're like, oh, we'll see, slow down, let's do it.
Yeah. So we done that, and it was just, it was probably like 10 tunes that we'd done that week, just one of 10 tunes. It was nothing like it took like half an hour probably just to get the initial version. And that was the version, we just made it to play out in nightclubs and for ourselves, nothing really behind it.
To the people that don't understand layman's terms, when you say slow it down, because I know what you mean, but can you explain that a little bit? What that means, slowing the track, because people hear the vocals like what exactly happened in the process?
Cool. All right, so then in Ableton there's the tempo. I mean, I suppose any DAW will have it, but we just automated the tempo. So obviously it has to be, the audio had to be warped so that it doesn't shift down the pitch of it. So it keeps the same pitch. But it slows down the tempo. So it slowed down the tempo to 100. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it goes down to, and it goes back up to 128. But yeah, it was just a case of just drawing a straight line from in the break down to 100 BPM and speeded it back up to 128.
I'm going to give you guys a little bit of some history.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first big records that did that with MIDI, we call it MIDI, you know, because now you work in the box, but back then you had to do this all in time clock. I got to give it up to Lil Lewis with French Kiss, because in the middle of the record it was going da 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 da, and the whole and then it sped up again, and it was 14 minutes this record. So when we started hearing that from you guys, we were like, wow, that's pretty cool, they're doing that again.
That's probably the record that we'd referenced that inspired us to do that.
Oh really? And obviously, Chris? Chris was the one you referenced off of?
I mean, it was for tempo slowdowns, definitely. It was because we love that record. And we used to play it, and it was like between that and a disagreement of what version that you that's where the idea came from
I'm going to have to run to the toilet. I'm busting. I'm sorry, guys. We're 2 seconds.
He's got to run to the toilet, to the loo. But anyway, because I'm thinking, well, that must have been maybe the record, because that record became a record that everybody tried to copy for years and years and years, in the sense of that technique of slowing the track down and speeding it up. And got to give up to Lil Lewis, because he's a genius with stuff like that. But that's how you found the record, huh? You were looking all over YouTube, scouring around. Did you have to go through crazy stuff to get a clearance on it and things?
Yeah, so we looked at clearing it, and they told us, I mean, because we had it on SoundCloud for I think 2 years or something. It was just sitting on SoundCloud for a free download prior to this. And it was getting a little bit of traction and stuff like that on SoundCloud, but then the record label wanted to sign it. So that's when you have to start clearing the stuff, obviously. And we asked to clear it, and they said it would have to be classed as a remix because it used quite a bit of sample. But we didn't want to do it as a remix. So we wanted to do it as our track, essentially. So we had got a replay of it. So it's not the original sample, and I'm afraid to feel it's a complete replay. The voices by we've got a different voice, and we've got a full band recreating the sample, and yeah, that was a way to get around the clearing. So we just had to play I had to get the publishing rights cleared the master rights and publishing rights. So yeah, it was just a roundabout way to do it.
Yeah, well, that's the interpolation. Did you guys do the actual recording of that, or you had sent out to have somebody else do it?
Yeah, we sent it away to somebody else to do it. I think it went through a couple of different iterations. Like we'd come back with some points and say we just wanted to try, because like we had such a close feeling with this original that we didn't want to go away from it. Because when it came back, it was a bit too clean and too well produced, and it didn't sound. I mean, it sounded great, but we had such like a bond with this original that we didn't want to change it from that. So I went back a few different versions, and then we ended up taking the stems and dirtying up a little bit to make it sound more.
Putting sampling it down a wee bit, a wee bit crunch in it.
To make it sound more like it was recorded in the '70s rather than recorded in 2022. We wanted to try and get
that. That's the problem when you do those replays sometimes. They're too clean, they're too clarified, they're too cleanly. Exactly. And us DJs, you know, our ears stuck to that original sound that we lifted off the record, or you just say, that's not Chicago. That's not Street Player. That's not, it sounds, yeah, Street Player, but it doesn't sound right. So how do you get around it? And I know that's tough sometimes when you're in that position.
That's the beauty in the old records is, like, some of the best dance music from that era, and had that sound that wasn't perfect. Even the drums, or sometimes the drums even were a bit, I'm not going to say flat, but they had their crunch to them. They weren't really, not got that clean kick sound what they've got today. But that was the magic in it. It's just like that dirt and that grit. It's just like can't really be recreated now in the box, really. So it's always hard trying to get around that and try to keep the elements of what made it special and where it came from and what year it came out and stuff.
Because I think we got the first version of like the interpolation back, and we were picking up on like the smallest of things. I think we were showing people like the original compared, and they're like, it sounds the exact same. But we were like, it doesn't sound the exact same. Like we could pick up these things, and we went back and forth. We're just making sure that it just sounded as close as possible, because otherwise it would have felt wrong. And I don't know, we're just glad that we stuck to it and trusted ourselves that we wanted to make it sound. It still sounds very clean now, but
a balance with how we wanted it and how the label, and obviously what is acceptable now for commercial use almost. So
okay, the record comes out, starts to do its business. You guys go from the neighborhood of the hood to world domination. Does your life change at all?
It did. It was like, I mean, it was almost instant.
Think about it. You went from, you know, doing some records that are making noise, and all of a sudden it's like,
oh,
it was almost instant. It was I mean, we were still working our day jobs right up until the week before it got released. It wasn't like we didn't leave our day jobs because of that song. It was just we were
DJing. Are you kidding me? Of course you did.
We had no idea this song was gonna do. It was just another song we'd released, and we were working our day jobs, but we were DJing a lot more because we had other records before that were doing a little bit well, and we were really desperate to get away from the jobs and focus full time on doing this. And we're making enough money that we could support ourselves and replace our day jobs. So the week before Fade Fuel got released, we quit our jobs. But then this happened. We didn't expect this to happen. And then it all happened. And then 4 weeks later, after it came out, it went number one in the UK. And that's when it all really changed. Was after that point, it just like everything you can imagine started happening to us, like offers for DJing and remixes, and I was almost instantly that everything changed.
And the with the job thing as well, this had been going on for a long time. Basically, I was coming in. I started it was like seven till four, or eight till four, whatever it was. Can't even mind. It's been that long ago, but. And I was coming in from work, and then because obviously we were starting to get through a lot more, I was coming from work doing eight hours of work on the tools, and then coming in and doing 6-8 hours in my studio, and I would be in there relentlessly, run through, eat my dinner. And then I wouldn't stop until my mum would come through, because my studio was right beside my mum and dad's bedroom. And then she would be like, right, I've got my bed, you need to turn it off. And I've still got so much to do. So I was so tired all the time. And I was getting really starting to get to me. I was just like, I'm working so hard. Like, how is this, like, all this is going on, but I'm still working. So I took convincing the manager, and because I kept asking for ages, like, when can we leave? When can we start looking at the books? Like, am I going to survive for at least even a year? A year with the money they were making to do this full time and really commit myself. And Sean was always the same. And then finally it gave us a green light. And then it happened. If the view happened, and then it just kept. Obviously went into the charts, started climbing it. I remember when the first day, whatnot, I went to like number 69, and me and Sean went straight to the pub. Went straight to the pub, started having a few pints, waiting for it to come on the radio to get called. And then my sister was out, we were going to Greece. My sister was getting married in Greece. And then at this point, we obviously had a lot of shows, so I turned up to the Greece, and I was flying in, flying out, blah, blah, blah. And then they say to me, the management and stuff, the agent said to me, relax, you can relax, like, enjoy the wedding. But, and then we got the phone call a day after the wedding, being like, I'm going to have to come to London. I'm like, what? Why? And like, he's a wedding number one. And that was on the Thursday. So flies, like, three connection flights to get back to London. And then his life went totally changed. And All these new opportunities came in, and all these gigs and traveling to all these places that, if this never happened, we would never. I look at some of the places I never knew existed, and that's just because I'm silly and I've not got good geography. But and then everything just took off. We would get so many opportunities. It's just like, it was. I can't even put it in words how different. And at times it got, is it further as it went in? At times it goes, it was so brand new. It got a bit tough. We were a bit like, whoa, this is a bit like full on. Because we've never been exposed to that life and how much was going on. It got a wee bit too mad at points, and where I was just like, and we were both struggling and not struggling, but like you're tired and weren't used to the life. And
you know, there's no preparation for it. There's nobody that says, this is what's going to happen. This is how, there's nothing written anywhere. Let me Google, what happens if my record goes number one? Is my life going to change? Answer. You know what I mean? There's nothing to go and look. You just have to just jump in and go. Like you said, you were in Greece. Sorry, guys, record went number one. You got to get back to London. What do you mean? What?
No. I'm trying not to. Not take away from my sister's special day and our special week, so try to keep it like low key, and everybody's like congratulating, like, obviously because we were already like, I think about number five or something like that. I don't know what it was, but so try to not take away the limelight and stuff like that. But obviously it was so brand new, even to like my family and friends, and like obviously you can imagine how exciting it was for them as well. But obviously it was so overwhelming. Next minute, out of nowhere, everyone's telling you how good you are and like how amazing it is, and out of nowhere it all shifted. Even though you were doing the same thing as what you always have been doing, but because that's one thing that happens, it then becomes a lot more serious, a lot more pressure on your shoulders. But it was, and it still is, the best time of my life. So,
and that's important. You know, I was told this a long, long time ago. As long as you can keep enjoying it, you do very well at it. The moment you don't enjoy it anymore is when it becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping we're not at that stage yet. That you
know, no. I still don't work anyway. I still don't see it as work.
Because I can put you back roofing and you can go back and do shelving at the petrol station. That's real work. Yeah. Nothing that there's nothing to be said negatively about it, but not everybody gets that chance to have that kind of success. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is lucky enough, because there is also hard work and a little bit of luck, because it has to be that right moment, and you were at the right moment. Something I want to ask you. You guys came up with EDM. And as EDM ended, and of course the Glitterbox story began, was it that you were drawn to the disco sound because of what happened with the whole Glitterbox thing? Or is it just something that you felt was necessary?
I was a growing up thing, mm-hmm. I think it's often the case in the UK and Scotland that it's almost like a rite of passage that you go through this, you go through like the more commercial sound, mm-hmm. because it's so accessible, and like dance music's big in Scotland, and a lot of the early stuff you listen to is really accessible dance music and mainstream dance music, and these you go to nightclubs and you experience more things and your mind opens. So I think it wasn't a choice, just a.
It was more like growing up that it's more of like the going out factor. It was your first experience of going out and getting drunk and listening to music, and that was kind of the music that your school friends did. Is all like land.
Yeah, Fiji Levels is your tune. That is your man, Fiji, and all those people coming out of Dutch were part of ruling the EDM scene. Yes.
I think it's another thing as well that when you're looking at YouTube tutorials and stuff at that age, it was like so EDM focused. There was no tutorials on how to do like good house music and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The only thing you could do was listen to it and try and figure it out. But it was so accessible. You could Google or YouTube how to make EDM and it would show you how to do it. And I think that's a big factor as well, that it was just so accessible that the information was there. And it still is like that, to be honest, but it's a bit more open that you can find a lot more tutorials. And
I do know that's true because people ask me to do tutorials on how to make music. I don't know if I want to do that. I like doing this better, but with I do understand that like everybody writes to me, can you show us how you made these records back then? I guess. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I think we wish.
Let's put it like this: you guys are now the guys to go to. So, people who don't know who's watching this show, I was blessed to get a phone call from my management saying to me that quietly for the last 6 or 8 months last year, they were talking to these fine fellas, and they were pushing some of my records from my catalog to them. And I don't know anything about this, but I'm going to let them tell you what they found out and what they did with a record of mine that I worked on with Byron Stingley from Tent City. Go ahead, guys.
Cool. We used to get a lot of emails, we still do, of like opportunities and stuff like that. And one day we got this email saying that your tune was available for sampling and usage, and obviously we were big fans before we'd even seen this opportunity. So when we seen the name, it was almost like this is probably going to be a yes straight away. So we took it and we listened, and we started the version instantly. Mm-hmm. We were on the way to the Isle of Wight Festival in the UK, and we started making a version on the boat across the festival, and we're dancing about the boat, blasting it out of the speakers.
Yeah. The boat was quite dead by this point. We was on the way home, and everybody was camping at this festival, so it was just like us. Thankfully,
it was quite a quiet boat. It was this massive boat, but it was really quiet, and we were sitting blasting this tune out of the laptop speakers, trying to make it.
Yeah, done better.
we were very grateful and lucky that we got asked to do it, because the original is so good.
It came about so quick, like honestly, that on the boat, just like straight away, it's one of those things. Obviously, like I say, all the elements that was in that track that he's made is perfect, and it had every bit. It was so good to sample a record, and then so instantly we just like nursed it away, and then we're like, let's just do it. And then obviously we had a couple of drinks as well, so that obviously helps the creativity. So we're on the boat, and then the version that's honestly It was a lot longer. We went down a route that was like, the first one I think was about 8 minutes long, so 9 minutes long. But we knew exactly what bits we wanted to use, and then and it just came about so perfectly. It was just, like, the one of those things that I fade to feel as well. You know, they had that thing where the certain tracks just take like 30 minutes, an hour to make, and because it's pure joy, it's like there's not stress on it. You're not overthinking it. It just comes out really naturally. And then I always think that I still think to find that the best solution to me.
So it didn't take you long to formulate putting that thing together, right?
No. Not at all.
Okay, it took me 10 days to put that together.
You've done the hard part.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Byron writes a song.
Mm-hmm.
No. I remember exactly how I did it. I sent it to Byron like you would do with it. You would send the instrumental track. So I sent the instrumental track to him. I played over the phone those days because we didn't have the way of doing that MP3 thing yet. Played over the phone and he went nuts for it. And he says, leave it with me. And it took him about a week and a half to write it. Came into New York, tracked it at my studio. And then I mixed it, worked on it, did the horn parts, some in Australia, some here, because I was on tour at the time. Yeah. And finished it, record did very well, put it away. And then here I find LF Systems later. And I'm like, when I heard it come back to me, I'm like, 8 minutes, I'm sitting there listening to it. I'm like, wow, it's great. I just was shocked. I don't even know, because it's, to me, it's an honor. Here's the reason why I say it's an honor for me. I never thought any of my records would ever be sampled like that. Because when I was doing stuff, I was sampling other people's stuff. So I was excited to be like, because I always wanted to do disco music. And when we were doing house music at that time, in the 90s, the golden era, into the 2000s, before the EDM thing exploded, it was exciting to think that I was able to do something that would be like a 70s record, you know? And then hearing it now, you kind of cyclically look at it later, like going back in time going, wow, it's pretty much like what I was trying to do back then, but just heavier, pushing harder, which is dope. So well done.
That must have, like, see when you said there, like, you were sampling records for your songs, but then now you've been sampled. That's like, that's a really cool thing. I think that, if we can, now that we're starting to make our original stuff now and go into sessions with some good players and try to recreate that thing that you've all done and make it right. So maybe one day, hopefully it happened to us, because that sounds proper really cool.
I know. It's also that's what the thing that we love, a big thing for us is like New York house music and Chicago and Detroit. As a man, it's probably one of our biggest things for us is that kind of music. Like, a lot of people don't, because we don't, a lot of people probably don't know that's what we kind of, that's like our first love is that kind of music. So, but that, I think when it came along from that era, it was something that we'd love to create. So the fact we got a chance to sample it was really good.
Yeah, especially when you asked me for the stems, I was like, yeah, no problem. Because I know Richard, they sent you over the tracks and then you did a proper snip up. And then I heard you wanted to go back in with the proper stems. I was like, yeah, I'll give you whatever you want. Because I got them all. I got all the parts. You know, the hardest thing for, you know, when you're doing records that you want to make sound like a 70s record is you kind of have to have everybody play a little off. They can't be completely on. Because those records were not made that way back then. They were made more loose, more like they were jamming. You know, it's not like, you know, like you said, couple of drinks and we're making tracks. Couple of drinks and we're making songs. And when things are too properly done and too clean, that's not the 70s. That's not the 80s. That's now. So,
exactly.
You know.
That's the magic.
Yes, the magic. And then taking the parts and then doing it with the computer clock and locking everything up and making it sound how you guys are doing it now and how Louis Vega or myself or Roger Sanchez, we're still doing this music because we love it, still have a fan base for it. it's just nice that you, both of you, have been able to capture that young audience to love it. That's in the most important part, because my fear always was, what happens when, you know, we were watching this EDM thing go for a long time and we were saying, is it ever going to come back? I asked Michael Grave from Full Intention. Even he started to say to himself, this is not coming back anymore. And then all of a sudden it came back. And we were like, thank God, disco, disco house, Jack in the house, new disco. Even when new disco started, even though it was slower, that's what I was going to ask you. Why is everything you're doing so up-tempo? Is there a reason for this?
I think we've had, because it's one thing that's been on our minds quite a lot recently, is obviously, especially in the UK, everything's really fast right now. Hard houses came back quite a bit, and everything's like 140, 138, and this really fast tempo stuff. So, and going to shows now, getting booked for shows, and obviously the music we make, given like your set time and stuff like that, that there's a massive thing where the music's so quick that it's hard to kind of slot in and play your stuff in that style, like without it sounding a wee bit like totally out of place, or like the crowd, because of the UK crowd, so like into that faster stuff, is like you end up getting a wee bit lost. So we had to find a balance with keeping our stuff, but also making it a bit harder, so that the people would like it enough to stick around and dance to it almost. And because it's like that thing, you don't want to get left, and that you can only do that thing for so long. That's, you don't want to get people just being like, oh, that, because that's how the UK scene is, and it was just, it's like proper thing. So it was like trying to find a balance where we can still be up there headlining, but without the energy kind of dripping from the young team and losing interest. So, but it's something that's been on my mind a lot recently. We've actually started slowing it down and trying to like, because if no one makes the move, especially the kind of sets that we do and maybe do them, if no one starts making the move of slowing it down a wee bit, then it's never going to come. Someone has to do it for it to come back and be accepted in that scenario. So
basically, what goes up must come down. Good. Let me give you an example of when that changed. Mojo's Lady track, which is a big classic. We had the same issue in the 90s too going on. Everything was getting faster and faster. And then all of a sudden, Mojo Lady came out and was like, whoa, this is really slow from what was, because UK Speed Garage was on the rise, and that was super fast. They were taking American records and high pitching them, and people were dancing. And we kind of thought it was the drugs too, a little bit, that was helping to make the people want the records faster. It's like with anything, Americans seem to want to make things a little more groovier and a little more slower. And we've found our counterparts, you guys, UK and Europe, a bit faster, a bit more chugging and pushing. Nothing wrong with it. That's what makes things that way. So good on you for taking the risk. Don't be afraid. Come on. Set the trend, because it happened already. You have history to look back at. It's not like it didn't happen. It's just a matter of the kids that are 18, 19 don't have no history. They're just going on what you show them, you know? Yeah, so everything you're doing. So you're in Miami now, and you got a full calendar of gigs through the year, I'm presuming, right?
Yep. It's not as busy as last year was, but yeah, pretty busy. well, in America quite a lot this year. It was just all over Europe, a lot of European festivals, UK shows. It's about a lot of the same again as what we did last year.
We decided to kind of slow it down this year a wee bit. Started towards the end of the year, started getting a bit, you know, you end up running a bit of steam, start running a bit of energy, and obviously the music gets starts getting backed up, and you're not able to get things finished. What you need to get done to obviously remain where you are. So this year we decided there's still a lot of shows, but we've said no to a few more than what we did last year to try and focus on music and really got on top of it, so that next year this year and next year we've got a hell of a more music coming out.
So what do you like better, studio or the road?
Oh, it's a tough one because I don't know. The buzz you get off playing live is unbeatable sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like the crowd, but like being in a crowd and seeing people dance and like just playing music that you love and music that you've made is such a great feeling. But there's like studio times, like it's like the bread and butter time. It's like that's your own space, your own time. You can relax. It's just like what you know, what you're comfortable doing.
Mm-hmm.
There's time and place for both. But
yeah,
it's hard to choose one.
Balance, seesaw. Too much to the right. Man, he's screaming at you. Where's the next record? You got to be at the gig. You got to do this. You got to do that. Parents are asking you, when are you coming home off tour?
Music, DJing, traveling, friends. It's just like that balance. You have to find that balance. And so this year, it's a big thing this year for ourselves and to give everybody a wee bit more LF is finding balance this year, and just go and make sure that next year we're locked and loaded with a lot of music. So,
Well, I've been hearing from around the world, because I've been traveling myself, that All I've Got has been a huge record for a lot of people, as I'm seeing. So let's hope and keep our fingers crossed that we got a really major story to tell.
It's
a great story already. Whatever happens, it already is great, and I can't thank you all enough, especially lending your time on tour to come on to True House Stories and sharing your story with us. And of course, next time we see you, you'll have children. You'll be with Elton John and all of them doing all those great records, and it will be like, so how's life now in the winner's circle with all the platinum and gold records around you? Of course, you know, as they say, caviar dreams, champagne wishes. That's all we can always ask for, in great health. Guys, thank you so much. Don't leave us. Catch us every week with a new show. And this is why we do it. LF Systems.
Thank you.
Leaders of the new school. Rocking it for you. Thanks again, everyone.